Welcome to the good, the bad, and the sequel Q&A. My name's Doug. So the next sequel that we're going to be covering is Scanners 2, The New Order. One of those sequels that I don't remember watching as a kid or seeing on the video store shelves, but Jamie doesn't either. So it's always fun when we're covering a sequel that we haven't both seen. So it's fresh eyes for both of us. And also, it's from that era that early 90s, but the 80s vibe still bleeds into it from the trailer I watched. So I'm excited. And for it, I chatted with actor Russell Yuen. Russell, now people, he's in so much that's so big right now. And it's good for him because he loves his craft. He's been doing it for a long time. You know him as Emperor Zhu in Three Body Problem, which I need to watch that. I've heard so many good things. And he plays Detective Peter Chu in Thanksgiving. So he has some cool behind the scenes about that movie. But yeah, Russell, he's from Canada. We talked about his family history, which was fascinating. His dad, you know, lying to fight in the war. That is something. But a lot about his lineage. But one of the most fascinating things, and I discussed a few other actors with Russell that had similar stories, but he was set to be pre-med. Like, he just wanted to, you know, be a kid, but all right, I'm going to do this. In Canada, they had this fascinating thing between high school and college, kind of like a junior college, so you could kind of figure out, like, what exactly you want to do. So he had one class to fill, and what do you think it was? Acting. It changed forever. So he had some amazing stories from his career. Obviously, some the beginning part of his career just being typecast. So he played a lot of, like you said, he knows martial arts. So obviously, it got him on set. A lot of martial arts, a lot of thugs. But then it changed. And we talked about the changing points in his career. An amazing story with Gene Hackman cracking his ribs. That's all I'm going to say. And probably one of my this is probably my favorite story of all time. I don't even spoil it, but about his first voiceover job. So he has a lot of voiceover credits. So I asked him, and it spawned a question. It spawned an answer that I was not prepared for, but I was laughing my ass off. So funny. Russell was great. I love talking to him. He truly loves it. Like, when we opened up, I don't know if it's I think it might have been before we started the interview. He loved everything behind me on my background. If you ever watched the videos of this at all or ever seen any clips on social media, at Sequels Only, I have all the VHS tapes, some autographs that people sent me, just little trinkets over the last 5 years that I've collected to have a really cool backdrop to give that vibe of me, like how much I love sequels and all these cool things that people have sent me. And then we started talking about, like, going when we were kids, the things our parents would sell on us. And that really showed me how much, even as a kid, he loved that, but he was going on this different path. And then obviously life works in mysterious ways. And now Russell is at 200 credits almost for his career, and he's not stopping, and he's giving back, which is really cool. Great stories about him helping out young actors, like the way he was helped out early in his career. That's another fascinating story. But yeah, before I start the interview, please like, share, subscribe, tell your friends, tell your mom, tell your ex. Might be weird, but you send her a text, hey, check out this interview with Russell Yuen, and then they'll be like, what? Then the husband will call you, he'll try fighting you. Maybe don't do that. Don't do that at all. And yeah, without further ado, here is actor Russell Yuen. Like, one of the things that you remember that you were, because mine was my wrestlers that I used to play with in the 90s, they were all gone. And what was your thing?
You see, I was kind of I was one of those kids that were groomed to be a doctor, you know.
Oh, okay.
So anything not science related would be gone, except my Legos would stay around.
Okay,
anything
that makes sense.
Not science related, yeah, because you know, Lego is it's good for the mind, right? You're being creative and logical at the same time. But yeah, I would have random, you know, just fun things that I would have as a kid, and I'd go to summer camp and they'd be gone when I get home. But all my stuff, like, you know, the human anatomy and the microscopes and all that stuff were all still there. And, you know.
Yeah, they multiplied. There'd be more of them somehow.
Well, yeah. I was one of those kids that, you know, I graduated from high school, and my gift was a brand new microscope. And I was just like, wow, thanks.
So you know, you grew up in Canada, Russell?
Yeah. I am born and raised in Canada. I'm a fourth generation Canadian. So officially, my family first came here for the railroad.
Okay.
I have one of those those typical immigrant stories where, you know, my grandmother owned a farm, which we worked on every summer.
Oh, my God.
My father fought in the Second World War for the Canadians. You know, that kind of typical immigrant history, you know?
Yeah.
Dad was also, Dad was the first Chinese guy to graduate from engineering at McGill.
Oh, my God.
You know, it was weird, random stuff, you know, like immigrant story
stuff. What part
stuff.
Of Canada? Like around Toronto? That part of Canada? Or...
No, Vancouver. I think I have more than 385 direct relatives in Vancouver somewhere.
That's awesome. Vancouver that was perfect for you. That was perfect for you. Is that why you didn't want to be a doctor? Because that's when, like around like some of your early credits, like 87, 89, that's like when that boom took off in Vancouver, when it was like the Hollywood North.
Well, yeah, but I wasn't there, unfortunately.
Okay.
So my family was in Vancouver, but after the war, my father apparently had the choice when they were shipped back from Europe. He lied about his age, by the way, to, you know, like most kids did back then. By the time they found out his real age, he was in Europe. And apparently my grandmother got a note saying, look, we know his real age. By the time we ship him back, he'll be of age. So we're just going to keep him here. But when he was shipped back, he had the choice of getting off in Halifax, Montreal, or Vancouver. And it's weird immigration story. In the army, he could never be by himself because they were always worried he'd be mistaken for a Japanese person and be shot at. So he had these two really large white French Canadian guys who were his buddies, who with him all. In fact, they were his buddies even after the war. Like they would come over to our house and hang out, and they told him, you got to come to Quebec. The hottest girls in Canada are in Quebec. Yeah. So my father, being a young man, said, well, I'm getting off in Quebec.
I'll be going to Quebec too, yeah.
That's how I ended up here in Quebec. My father wanted to, you know, and what's funny is that after he passed away and after my mother passed away, my mother and my father were friends. They weren't seeing each other, but he was sending my mother letters with these pictures of all these white French Canadian girls he was dating at the time, you know, one after another. And we're just like, oh my God, my dad was a playboy. What the heck?
Oh my God. So primarily you grew up in Montreal. That was like your childhood.
I was born and raised in Montreal in a little tiny district called Pierrefonds, which translate in English to rock bottom. So it's kind of a,
yeah,
I know. So I grew up there speaking French and English. And in fact, my first acting role wasn't in English. It was in French.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So
You obviously speak it fluently. Like that is how common, like if you go into a store, is it like either or it's like first French, then like
yeah,
English?
No, it's for me, it's either or. But of course, here in Quebec, the official language is French. So
yeah,
it's funny here in Quebec because you'll go into a store, you'll go into a place, or you'll go into any place and you'll meet somebody and you'll both be speaking French for the longest time until one of us goes, wait a second, are you English? And you go, yeah. So, and then you switch out into English afterwards. But
that's
funny. Everybody speaks French at first. And then if the person's English, you'll speak English to them.
Yeah. That's such a wild thing. So yeah, obviously you're like, a hockey fan, right? Are you a hockey fan?
I'm a bad Canadian.
I'm going to throw you out.
I'm not a hockey. No, I'm a football fan. I'm okay, a big football CFL, fan. Yeah, CFL. So I do that. I do that weird thing where I'll fill up my PVR with first CFL stuff, and then college college football from the States, and then I'll watch all the NFL stuff in the States. So that's my PVR is jam packed with all that, you know, which is going to start very soon.
Yeah, no, you know, that's pretty cool. Like that, you do that because a lot of the because that's like the feeder system, you know, college football to CFL, right? Is it, do they play football in colleges in Canada?
They do, but it's not as big as it is in the States. But it's getting bigger. But you know, it's all population thing, right? Like we can't fill up stadiums like you guys do because we just don't have that massive population.
I
think the population of Canada fits into the state of Florida.
I know, it's that's one thing that people don't think about Canada. When you look at it, you're like, wow, this is vast. Even if you take away like the northern section, when you know, like, okay, it's not really inhabitable, so there's not much there. But like even just the border of the United States, it's like the major cities are like major cities, like Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal. Yeah. Like there's major cities, but along the way it's like very sparse, like desolate. There's areas that there are more are many people, but that's awesome. So you mentioned earlier the doctor stuff growing up. So what was what got you into acting? Was it theater in school, watching a movie? How did that come about?
I was on my way to pre-med and I needed
You were there. You were already
I was almost there. I was almost there. I needed a stupid course. So we have a in our system, we have between high school and university, we have a stopover. It's called CGEP. And CGEP was developed it was developed right after the war, and it was in order it was really a place so that people after high school, if you want to go into the trades, you can get either 2 or 3 years of further education, and then you get the trade education. But instead of going to university, so we have that because our school system starts at, stops at grade 11.
Oh, okay.
Right? That's why. So we have that little stopover, and that, so you take more courses there to prepare you for university. And I was heading towards pre-med, and I said, I need a stupid course, something that's a throwaway. And I took a drama course. And when I took that drama course, I was like, oh, this is, so it lit something inside of me I didn't know existed. But I should have known better, because at that time, my brother was a song and dance man.
Oh, and, really?
But he was doing that on the side, though. He was trying to do the proper Asian thing. So he went to McGill in engineering, like my father. And I believe at the time, he was already working for IBM as the head of security for IBM here in Montreal.
Oh, okay.
But on the side, like on the weekends and the nights, he would be a song and dance man with different groups. So I should have had an inkling that was in my blood. But I took a drama course, and then I said, okay, what do I do? So I talked to the university advisors, and they said, look, you're about to start, you know, going into your courses in order to enter into pre-med. We'll give you 5 years. We'll hold all your credits for 5 years. And so try it out and see what happens. So I tried out in 5 different theater schools. And I said, if none of the 5 accept me, I know my destination is medicine. All 5 accepted me, so I was kind of screwed. So that's, and then I just said, okay, I was going to go to a few of them, but then I realized I couldn't afford a lot of them, because another thing that changed my life a lot is my father passed away when I was 11.
Oh,
so
wow.
I started financially supporting my mom at 13. So I needed to be able to work and go to school at the same time, you know? So I picked the budget conscious school that would also allow me to get a good theater background. And that was Concordia University. So then I did 3 years at Concordia University, and it was hard because I believe there's 800 applications a year minimum. They pick 15 a year, and then out of the 15, 8 of us graduated, and then out of the 8 that graduated, only 2 of us work still.
Wow, isn't it? It's insane. Well, it's that hard of a business. It's that hard. Wow. So what was your? Did you have to do an audition, or how'd you get in? Okay, cool. Wow.
Well, that another strange story. I had no idea. You know, I've never performed in my life before. I've never acted. You know, I just did that little drama course in CJEP, and they said, well, there's a really long audition process, and it actually lasts. There's a first audition, and then you have a whole weekend of auditions. So the first audition is just you go in with a monologue, and then they'll ask you to do some other stuff. I didn't know what a monologue was. I didn't know any of that stuff. So I made one up. I wrote one myself. A monologue about my, and they said, what would be like cool or interesting? And I didn't know a lot. So I made one about my dad's funeral. Like, you know, what I recall as a kid as my dad's funeral. And I passed the first audition with that. And then wow. you had a weekend, a Saturday and Sunday, where you spent the Saturday, they spent the whole day putting you through exercises and stuff like that. And then they cut off a whole bunch of people. Then Sunday you come back and you do a whole day of other workshops and movement. And again, I'm a science guy. So there I am being a tree and you know, asking me to do stuff I've never done in my life before. And then on Sunday night, they post up the list of who was accepted. And surprisingly, my name was on the list.
Oh my God. That's awesome. So
that's how I got. And then I studied, you know, Shakespeare, Moliere and all that stuff. And the big surprise for me was when I graduated theater school. Because you have to imagine this was what, 37, 38 years ago. So, you know, I wanted to quit theater school at one point. Because everybody in my class was telling me I was only there because they needed one visit by minority per year.
Ugh,
and, but you know, these are all people that came from theater backgrounds, right? They've already done theater school, and now this is like the ultimate program for them. And so you got the science geek coming in who obviously had no idea what the hell he was doing. I think in second year, I wanted to quit. And God bless him, he's passed now. Joe Cazalet, he was one of those guys who was a chain smoker. And back in the day, you would go into his office and he'd be rolling one cigarette while smoking another one.
That's amazing.
And I went into his office and I said, look, Joe, I need to quit. I can't do this anymore. And he said, well, fine, if you want to quit. But I'm not signing your papers. And this means in university, if he doesn't sign off on you, you lose all the money that you spent on the credits.
Oh, wow.
Right? And I'm just like, holy crap, I can't afford that. You know, I'm supporting my mom. I'm, you know, I can't do that. So I said, okay, I'll tough it through. And God bless him, because he told me at the end, he said, the reason why I didn't let you go is because if you can make it through this theater program, you can make it through the industry. And he was right, because the hardest part of my whole career was getting through the theater program.
Yeah.
But after I graduated, the shock for me was there were no speaking roles for Asians. If you think about it, back in the day, right, there were absolutely no roles for Asians. Why is my email on still? One second. Do I have to turn this off? Oh, it's because I have your email open. There you go. And so after I graduated, I ended up having to do stunts and martial art films
Really?
For about 8 to 10 years. Yeah. So,
oh my God.
A lot of my first 8 years of my career was all like, thank God I knew martial arts. I did a lot of Shaolin Kung Fu. And so I was able to use that in order to stay in the industry. And then slowly, you know, 10 years after graduation, you know, they would need the token guy, the token Asian gangster to say, you know, one stupid line with an accent, you know, oh, yeah. You think you're so tough, you know, something like that, you know, and then gradually the lines increased and my career got better, thank God, because at this age, I could not do stunts anymore. No.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. No, it's terrible. The whole just the way all minorities, like I talked to an actor, this guy, Rico Ross. He was in Aliens. He was in like Death Wish 3, but he was in a bunch of stuff. And it's so funny. Like you look at his career, you would think just like yourself, you're like, oh man, they must be a stunt person, martial artist. Him, it's like, oh, you know, he's just going to be like, he's like a badass guy. He was like a Shakespeare trained guy. Like he trained in England. And he was like, man, I'm not going to take this shitty role. Like he's like, I'm not going to take this. And then he got, you know, and then he got some roles, but it's like, it's terrible when you think of old movies. That's why I always laugh at people nowadays when they're like remaking movies and casting minorities in these roles that were in the original, you know, white people. And I'm just like, do you understand when those movies were made? It was like, they were only casting white people. Like even in roles that were written, people were like changing their face color and stuff. And it's like, it's, you know, it's fair now, more fair. It's never, you know, eventually, hopefully it becomes fully an even playing field, but you still see that in some of it. But wow. So do you remember your first like role? So like some of the early, like you mentioned, you played like a thug in some early roles. Do you remember the first time being on a set? Because that must've been like a shock too. Again, just like the audition process for getting in Concordia, it was like, okay, hear something you had no idea, monologue, hey, there's this weekend thing, you're gonna be a tree, you're gonna do all these like weird like who's that Stadler, the one famous acting coach that's in New York. Well, they were in New York, but it was like
there's a couple actors.
Stadler.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
It sounds like that. But I remember I talked to an actress. She was talking about all the people in her class, and they were all like big names. Like, the hell's his name? He just passed away a few years ago.
Also, there's Rotenberg, and yeah, there's Rotenberg too. Anyways, there's a whole bunch. Yeah.
Yeah. But she was like, yeah, the one day for 2 hours we were fake sleeping, and snoring and drooling, and it's like, if you're not ready for that, you think it's like, wow, this is like. It's use your imagination. Like the more fun you can have and almost have like a childlike mind, no matter when you're acting, whereas it is when you think about it in the grand scheme of things, it's a very silly thing while you're in it. But then afterwards, when you see that finished product, it's like, oh my God, this is amazing.
You know, because now I give a lot of lectures for beginning actors.
That's
and I
awesome.
Also coach some actors for parts and for auditions. But a lot of times I just have to remind people that acting is just like when you were a kid in the backyard and you picked up a stick and suddenly it was a laser gun or a laser sword and it didn't matter, right? But and we as kids believed it 100%, right? Because remember the arguments you used to get? It's like, dude, I shot you. You know you didn't, you missed me. No, I shot you. Because that's what acting is. It's really being a big kid playing the backyard, but being paid for it. That's the only difference.
Yeah.
You know? And if you approach acting like that, because you have to have joy. It took me 20 years to understand that, you know, my career really started taking off when I understood that I need to have fun on set. And when I understood that, that's when I started to really, oh, okay. You know, this is how it works. You were asking, remembering my first, I remember the first time I was on set, it was on a French TV series. And thank God I was playing a computer geek. because I could be as awkward and as uncomfortable as I wanted to be, and it fit the character completely. But because back then I was definitely the token, like the whole cast was white, you know, and I was like the only one visible minority. And at one point, an interviewer in French calculated it out. So in the whole two seasons I did of this French TV series, I averaged one line an episode. And I was just like, what? He goes, yeah, you averaged one line per episode. I was like, wow. But that's where I learned a lot about this, because one of the advantages of going to Concordia was, unlike a lot of other theater programs, they had an agreement with the film and TV program. So there was a film and TV production program that was going on in another building. So once a semester, we had a chance to work with them.
And, oh, that's awesome.
You know, they would give us
huge.
So the students would give us a small script, and we'd memorize the script, and we'd go over and work with them. So you got the chance to learn all the terminology, learn how to work with the cameras with students. So I made the majority of my huge mistakes at university before getting to set. But still, it was, you know, like now there's actually, you can actually go and get film and TV terminologies for dummies book, you know, it's available. And I wish it was available when I started, because there's so many things that they would say to you, like, okay, this is the window shot. Are we shooting in front of a window? No, we're not. So why, what are we doing? It's the last shot of the day. You know, I'm like, oh, okay. So it was weird.
But at least you had that experience. That's what's so cool. There's so many things that I love about Canada, and that's really neat that I'm fascinated by. I have to do more research on the between university and high school. I think that's so cool, because that's such a weird time. Like, I went to school for like a little bit at that point, but I had no idea. So I went right to working, doing sales, but that's such a weird time. At like 17 to 20, you're supposed to like choose what you're going to do for the rest of your life, which is like a lot of pressure for, you know, that age, that mind to make. I know I didn't make it. I'm, like I said in my email, I'm an accountant now. I did sales for most of my life until 5 years ago. I went back to school, but that's cool. So that was on Scoop. Was that the series you were on as a?
Oh my God, you did look at my shit. Yes, it was on Scoop. Yes,
that's cool. No, because I was gonna say that's pretty early on, and I know credits never are 100% accurate. And like earlier ones of movies that I know, and it's so cool. Like from interviewing a lot of people, there's so many movies that filmed in Canada there back then because it made so much sense. Like, was Trudeau's dad in charge then or no? Or was he was
in charge
lot
of what the
of Canada? Trudeau, his father was the 70s.
Oh yeah, I think Pierre. I think Pierre was the, I think he was back then, yeah.
Yeah, no, because I'm just thinking about it. That was when that boom happened. But like Scanners 2, you play like convenience store thug. There's like so many movies that you wouldn't think like would shoot there. But now after doing this for so long, it's like, you know what? You shoot, even in the States, it's like, oh, why are they shooting in Georgia? And they're pretending that it's Pennsylvania. It's like, well, Georgia's giving credits. You know, they're giving money to
Georgia's
shoot
giving
there.
Tax credits. That's why we're going, yeah.
Exactly.
You know, and that, do you feel, and a lot of times, you know, sorry, go on.
No, you're good. You're good.
No, I'm just saying that a lot of times it is funny because, you know, it's so expensive nowadays to film in so many different places. I mean, that's why even Canadian productions will leave Canada and shoot somewhere else just because it's cheaper, you know?
Yeah. No, it's like wherever you can stretch the dollar. And you know, now it's like the mindset of some filmmaking is the mindset of like the Roger Corman of the quicker you can film it, the quicker you're able to obviously save money on it. One credit that I wrote down that you were in, I love this, and I don't even know if Roger Corman did this or it was like the Canadian Roger Corman, but The Lost World.
Oh my God, yeah.
So a movie that came out probably the same year as Lost World. But they use the same name. That was like a very Roger Corman thing to do, to do a play on the movie that was popular like the year or two before.
Yeah, except I think we had like 1/16th of the budget or something.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's the one where I played twins, actually.
That's pretty wild. How was, like, doing something like that? Like, that is,
It was...
That's fascinating. Like,
it was fast. Yeah, it was fascinating. It literally was a wig and a little bit of makeup, and that was it. And it was weird because there were scenes where I was talking to my brother, and so we would record one side of it, and then, but, you know, technology wasn't, like, nowadays, if you play a twin, you'll record it, and they'll set up a monitor so that you can act to your own image.
Oh,
we
yeah.
didn't have that ability back then, so it literally was me doing part of the scene, and then a tennis ball being set up on a stand and a poor script person trying to imitate the way I spoke and me reacting to a tennis ball. And that was, you know, that was high tech back then.
That was, I'm sure it was.
But yeah, it was. the special effects of that movie were horrible. Yeah.
That was like that weird time, like when it, like obviously with the budget of that and like a lot of like indie movies, it was like Jurassic Park was like the, or like Terminator 2 is like the movies you look to as like the pinnacle of like that early CG, like the way they nailed it. There's so many movies that came out like right around that time that had big budgets. They just went with the wrong company because there were so many people that were saying, oh, I can do that. And they were like trying to do it, but they weren't.
Well,
so it was
that production was smart though, because they didn't try to be that good. They knew they didn't have the budget for it, so they ended up making it that, you know, that little bit of a campy style, and you know, like it was like, I don't know if you remember what was it, the old black and white movie Aladdin, and this, I think it had skeletons in it that were fighting as pirates.
Oh, yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah. Seven Voyages of Sinbad, one of the Sinbad movies.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you are a film fanatic. So it was that kind of style. Like it didn't, it looked bad enough that nobody, that everybody accepted it. That's the style of the movie, you know?
That's cool.
So, and what's weird is that when I travel sometimes, I actually see that movie. Like,
really?
You know, I still see it being broadcasted. It's just weird.
You never know what's ever, like, when people make movies, they never know. Like, whenever you watch any of those behind the scene things, it's like, you'll see, like, the two actors or the actor, the director be like, you think we'd be sitting here 30 years later? Or even when I talk to people, I'm like, can you believe you're being asked about this movie? It's like, honestly, when I was done with it, I'd never have thought. Because nobody thought of a future of having on demand, or even like video stores, depending on the people that I interview. But most of them, they were like, when I'm done, I was just like, all right, on to the next one. Because there was not, people weren't paying. Like, I have some VHS tapes that, like, we were talking about before we started recording. Like, one on there, it's like $30 is the price tag because somebody opened it. I'm like, do you imagine even nowadays spending $30? Like, back in the day, if I was a kid, I'd be working like almost 20 hours to buy a movie.
Yeah. That's a lot of money back then, man.
I know.
Especially when you look at laser discs, they were really expensive. I mean,
were super expensive. And the player was ridiculous. Oh. Yeah.
And it was ridiculously huge, too. I mean, I remember it was like the size of a suitcase or something. But, I remember going over to a friend's house and they had a laser disc and I just couldn't get my mind around it. You know, like the... seeing it work, you know, it was like, wow. But then again,
it's,
I grew up in the age when, sorry?
No, I was going to say, it's funny because at the same time, we had the technology of the CD. So it's almost like you're thinking like, oh my God, why does this have to be so much bigger? And then like, it was like not even that long later, they were like, oh yeah, we actually figured it out now. It was like not, like probably five years after they went obsolete.
Yeah, crazy. That was a fast technology because people spent a fortune on that and it changed so fast.
Yeah, no, they got burnt. People that invested in those got burnt.
I think I still have my Walkman though. I still have my Walkman somewhere. My Discman. I still kept my Discman. Yeah, yeah.
The Discman, and it had on there like the anti. What was it? God,
anti-skip
it was like
anti technology or
yeah, it was like anti skip, and it was like for some reason there was a button to turn that on. It's like, why would you never not have that on for any reason? But so Russell, you were talking about like
it because it used more battery power.
Oh, you know what? That's probably why. And then you have to carry extra got a world of batteries. Like my Game Boy, I used to always have like so many batteries with me for like road trips, and God, such good memories. Kids have it easy now. My daughter has a tablet that stays charged for almost like a day, so she could really just play on it.
I know,
all day long. It's not fair.
No. I remember saving up so much money to go to Radio Shack. I don't know if you guys, I don't think you ever had Radio Shack back there, but
yeah, we did. Like this, yeah, we had Radio Shack in the States. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. So I would save. I remember saving up to get a recharger, like a battery recharger at Radio Shack, but I couldn't buy the batteries yet. You know, so I got the charger and then I had to save up more money to get the batteries, you know? Yeah. It's just like, and they sucked back then, by the way.
Oh, those things? No, I know. Yeah, no. They didn't last as long as like buying like a Duracell or something. So what would you say was the big turning point? So you talked about, obviously, you were playing like typecast roles for a while, like the martial arts, playing like a thug, or when you were on the series and had like a line or two. What was like the one that you would say that you remember like as like that turning point? Either turning point as in personally that you're like, I can do this forever, or turning point that somebody saw something and you're like a casting director and that changed like the trajectory.
I have to say it's probably the Red Violin.
Okay.
And why? It was because, well, first of all, it was the first time I worked with Sandra Oh. So,
cool.
You know, I got to work with her a few more times afterwards. But it was the first time working with Sandra Oh. She just graduated from the National Theater School, and she was like this big, big name here in Canada. You know, like everybody in Canada knew she will be a star. And I was working with a really well-known director, and it was Colm Feore was in it, and Samuel Jackson. So you know, it was the first film where I got to really act. And yes, I was playing an Asian guy, but I mean, I play Asian guys all the time because, you know, I'm Asian. But
yeah,
but it was really that turning point for me where I was the first time I was actually appreciated as an actor. You know, like they didn't come up to me and say, okay, you know, this time when Dolph Lundgren hits you, can you just throw yourself a bit more? No, it wasn't that. It was, you know, Russell, what do you think that this character would do? You know, like, do you think he's really sad about remembering the violin, or do you think it brings him happiness? And it was just, they're talking to me, not telling me what to do, you know? And that probably was the first time I felt, oh my God, this is what an actor is. This is really, really what I want to do. The Red Violin really gave me that push at the part of my career where I was doubting if I could do this, or if I could stay in it, or if I had it in me, you know?
Yeah, just people want to be involved. I've talked to like directors and, you know, and actors, and they love the ability to be a part of it, even if it's like a simple question is like you mentioned, like, hey, how do you think they should feel? Or, hey, do you want to try a line here? Or even if it doesn't make the final cut, like for if you let people just like throw out like improvised lines on the set, like for the rest of that shoot, that actor is going to think like, hey, you know what? I was able to like give myself into the scene.
Yeah.
But that's great, man. Because that's perfect. That's like you said, around that 10-year time that you're in the business.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's a hard business to get into. And just for you to go through it all, just like your professor said, If you can make it through here, you can make it through the industry. It's kind of like the same thing. You had that first 2 years, almost like 10 years of it.
Yeah.
That was kind of difficult. But you had the drive and you got that opportunity from there.
The second boost for me probably was when I did a film with Gene Hackman and David Mamet. And I was scared shitless because I grew up watching Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
You know, it's Gene freaking Hackman, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember, I mean, I was a young kid and Gene Hackman saw that I was nervous and he, you know, came over and talked to me and he was telling me stories about when he first started acting. You know, he said, you know, you got to make yourself noticeable, Russ. And I go, what do you mean? And he said, well, the first job I got, I was an extra in a Western. And he says, but I wanted to be on that set longer. So he says, at one point, they just wanted me to take my hat off and dust off my jeans. And he said, but I made a meal out of it. I took off my hat. I dusted off my whole body. He said, it was impossible for them not to use me again as an extra because I was like that big puff of dirt and cloud. He said, you saw me. He said, so he said, that's how I started. He said, I started that way. I became an extra and they had to keep using me as an extra and they threw me a couple of lines. So he got me relaxed. And then the real boost came when we were doing a scene together and David Mamet comes up to Gene Hackman and says, what do you think of the scene, Gene? And I go, he says, it's not working for me. And I thought, oh, that's it. I'm being fired from the set. It's obviously not, it's because of me. It's not working because of me. And David Mamet goes, no, he says, I didn't write the scene properly at all. He goes, he's looking at Gene Hackman and he goes, let's go to my trailer while they finish the setup and we'll rewrite the scene. And I'm thinking they're going to write me out. They're just going to write out my character. It's not necessary. Yeah. You know, I mean, the scene's not working because of me. They're going to write me out. So I'm prepared to hear, okay, Russ, you're now an extra or something in the background, you know? And as they're walking away, David Mamet turns back to me and he goes, what the fuck are you waiting for? Come to my trailer. We got to rewrite the scene.
Oh, man.
I was just like, oh my God, you know? So as a young kid, I'm like, I'm coming. I'm playing. So there we are in a trailer, Gene Hackman, myself and David Mamet, improvising this scene, trying to figure out how to get the scene to work better. And then finally we get it. He scribbles down a few things. The script person is there. She's taking notes and they go, okay, well, that's great. Rusty, are you happy with the scene? Well, I'm happy with the scene. Yeah, that's good. And we go back and we're doing the scene. And I didn't realize that, you know, Gene Hackman is a big boxer, right? He loved boxing a lot. And I didn't realize he trained the day before. And in the scene, at the very end of the scene, we have a fight and he punches me and I go down on the ground and that's how he gets past. I'm a security guy and that's how he gets past me. But I didn't realize, he didn't realize either that he hurt himself the day before boxing. So when he hit me, we both heard the distinctive celery stick break. And I went down in the pile. It looked great on camera, but he cracked my two ribs.
Oh, he and cracked your ribs? Oh my God.
He cracked my ribs, Gene Hackman, because his hand was like twice the size of mine. You know, like
yeah.
He had boxer hands. And so there I was. And then I ended up in the hospital afterwards. And then Gene finished his day of shooting. And the next thing I know, David Mamet and Gene Hackman are in my hospital room checking up on me to make sure I'm okay. And I'm like, okay, I really want to do this job.
Yeah, this
you know
is
that
like,
was another
this makes
point
it all
me.
Worth it. That is like,
yeah,
that's awesome. Like to have that experience, and it's like so great for like a person like Gene Hackman, like even yourself now, like you know, coaching and helping people that are up and coming. That like you were, you know, maybe somebody didn't extend that olive branch early on, but like, just to think about that, like Gene Hackman, they're just like everyone else, you know? And it's so cool that he felt that he sensed from you like the nerves and, So that's great.
And I try to do that now. I always try to give actors what I wish I got you know, like starting off in the industry. A lot of times I'll be on set and there'll be this brand new actor who's nervous as hell. You know, they got to walk in, say one line, walk out, and they're nervous as hell. And you know, but I'm the guy who will go and talk to them and say, hey, it's okay. Don't worry about it. Just, you know, forget all the cameras. Just talk to me. You know, forget. Nobody else exists. Walk in and talk to me. You know, and I'm also the guy that gets in trouble a lot by production because I make it a point to talk to all the extras, all the background.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of productions don't like you doing that. But in my head, if it wasn't for the background doing their job properly, then you have no production, you know?
Yeah.
You end up with a film like, what was that? The Tom Cruise one where he goes into New York and it's completely empty. Magnolia? Was it?
Oh, Magnolia. Yeah, Magnolia has a scene like that. And also the Will Smith movie is like purposely like that. Like in I Am Legend.
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah,
even
that one too.
After COVID. Yeah. The first movie that I like filmed right after COVID was that one with Denzel and I forget the name of it, but it's so weird because there's no background and they're in places that are public places. So they're like a coffee shop and there's like one worker, but like nobody walking around the street. It's like bizarre. So yeah, no, background's important.
So that's why I'm making
really
a point.
Is.
Yeah. And if they're not doing their job, like if somebody looks straight at the camera, you know, then you'll have to redo that shot again.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, I make it a point to, I bend a lot of rules on set now.
Bend the rules. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you said, you want people to, you know, just like Gene Hackman made you feel, you want people to feel welcome and feel like appreciated and, you know, they're going to keep doing it. You know, if you're somebody's good background, good, you know, guy at coffee stand, you know, those are people that are key for movies. People don't think about that.
You know, it makes everybody's performance better too, right?
Yeah.
And if everybody's performance is better, then my performance is better. So, you know, maybe selfishly, I'm just helping myself.
Yeah, selfishly, yeah. And then, like, I know you mentioned early on, like, one of your first roles was, like, doing, like, voice, like, a French, but you have a lot of voice credits too. So how did that come about, like, doing cartoons?
Well,
and video games too.
Geez. Yeah, a lot of video games. I've been lucky with the voice world. I have to tell you a funny story about my first voice job ever.
Yeah.
Before I even finished, just after I finished theater school, and before I became a union member, I was looking for, I've never done any voice work. So I was, you know, looking for a non-union voice job that I could practice on or at least try, like, to be in a studio or... And back in the day, we had newspapers. So I was looking at the classified ads in the newspaper, and there was actually voice job for non-union actor. And you had to be able to speak French and English. And I'm like, oh my God, I'll do that. And there was an audition, but all you had to do was phone a number and leave a voice sample on the number in both French and English. So I called the number, left it. I left my home number because, again, we didn't have cell phones back then.
Yeah.
I get a call back and they said, yeah, you got the job. Come to this address on this day and you'll do some voice dubbing. I'm like, oh my God, my first voice dubbing job, you know? And so I go to this place in Old Montreal, and I get to the address, and it doesn't look like a studio. It looks like a basement. So I said, you know, non-union, I totally get it. Maybe it's just, okay. I walk in, and of course, the door has a curtain right in front of it. I said, oh, it's different. I guess maybe for the sound, I don't know. I walk in, and this It smells like cigarette smoke. Again, you were able to smoke inside back then. And I get there, and the director is there, and he's like, oh, great, great, great. He goes, have you done voice work before? And I said, no, this is my first time. I hope you don't mind. He goes, no, no, your voice is great on the recording. It was fine. He says, we have a really experienced actor. She'll walk you through it. I said, great. And then I walk into the studio, which wasn't a studio per se. It was like just the living room part of this place with a curtain. And there was one big TV, one really bad microphone, and a really old grizzled lady with a cigarette. And she talked like this. And she goes, sweetheart, I'm so glad you're here. It's good to have fresh voices. I said, hi, nice to meet you. She goes, bienvenue, bienvenue. And she goes, sit down, c'est sweet, toi, là, puis va commencer, we'll give to start, you know? I said, okay. I said, what are we doing? She goes, don't worry about it. She goes, you just, whatever you see on the TV, just try to voice it over in English. I said, okay. She goes, it's a French movie. We're doing the English version. Just try your best to match it. And the director says, it doesn't matter if you're not perfect. It doesn't matter for us. I said, okay. The movie starts. It's a porn. It's a porn film. And I'm dubbing French porn into English porn. And I'm just like, holy crap. And that was my first voice job. I spent the whole afternoon in this horrible studio with a smoking woman doing, you know, and just like, and they're doing stupid lines like, hey, you ordered a pizza? You know, and that was like that kind of stuff. That was my first voice job.
I love the fact that where it was recorded was probably where they would film a movie like that, in a basement.
Yeah,
with a curtain.
Yeah.
Just like, it's a way to start, you know? And, you can only go up from there.
I felt there was nothing lower than that, you know? Yeah, yeah. So, and I was just glad it was a non-union job. That's all I could say.
Yeah.
But how did they get
into the I was just looking at
other,
some of the shows that you did. Voice it was like Ripley's Believe It or Not, The Country Mouse and The City Mouse.
Yeah.
Like a lot of credits on those.
Yeah. A lot of it had to do with, again, being a kid. As a kid, I would do a lot of different voices just to amuse myself. And so when you get an agent, there are some agents that are just general agents. Well, they'll do film, TV, and voice. Other agents only do film. Other agents only do voice. I had a general agent, and she would get me these auditions to do animation work. And I literally would just, back in the day, you would just go into a studio on the audition day. They would give you some lines to read, and you would give your take on those lines. You know, they would give you a piece of paper with like a sketch of the character, a description of who he's like, and then you try your best. And that's how I got into the voice business. And of course, then once you start doing animation, you get known in the animation world doing certain voices. And then as soon as you start doing, you know, games for Ubisoft and other video game people, they know that, oh, Russell really does those voices, these type of voices really well. And, you know, I just kept getting hired over and over again.
Yeah, Far Cry. I played those games. It's pretty, like, the one I'm fascinated about is, like, Ripley's Believe It or Not. What were some of the voices you did on there? Like, one of the main voiceover voices, or?
Yeah, I believe I was one of the main voiceover narrators for Ripley's Believe It or Not, if I remember properly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can sort of hear it in your voice.
Yeah. Well, I actually do, they'll often give me like a George Takei reference for sci-fi narration, you know? So a lot of times they'll be doing something and they'll be like, can you do like a George Takei thing? I'm like, You mean you want something like this? Way back when, Stardate 24, 16, 32. You know, like, yeah, it's you just, again, it just goes back to when you're a kid, right?
Yeah, you're just being silly.
I would do all sorts of voices, you know? And of course, back in the day when things started getting PC, if there was an Asian accent, well, then you got to hire an Asian guy to do the voices. And I was one of the few Asian voice actors back then. So they would hire me to do all the different voices for Asian characters, you know?
Yeah, that's good for
like
you.
I did a Journey to the West, I think. And I was like, that was a huge whole bunch of series. And one of my first big animation jobs was Journey to the West. And all I did was the narrator, you know? And again, it was another voice that I played with when I was a kid. Yeah. It was a long road and we had to travel many days. But finally, we found the destination. You know, it's just, it's kids' voices that you do.
Yeah, that's amazing. Oh, man. Russ, it's been so much fun. Here's one thing I have to mention before we're done is because it became such a huge movie. And I don't know, like when you're filming a movie, I don't know if people, it's like whenever you're working on a movie, you're working and then it's done. You never know what the reception's going to be. But like Thanksgiving, like that movie, I don't know. Obviously, it has Eli Roth attached. So you have obviously like his history. It's like a lot of people, you know, John Carpenter made a movie tomorrow. People are going to go see it because it has his name attached. Yeah. But like that movie like blew up and has a phenomenal cast.
Yeah, I mean, like it really blew up. That's the difference. The Three Body Problem has a huge viewership because it's on Netflix, but Thanksgiving has this cultish following.
Mm-hmm.
And your question is: Do you know when you're doing it? Is it going to be a success? Is that it?
Yeah.
You know. At certain points in a movie, you get a feeling whether or not it's going to be good or not. There's been many movies where I've been on where I turned, you know, myself and another actor, we turn to each other and we go, holy crap, this is shit, you know? But on Thanksgiving, I spent a lot of time with my friend Jeff. You know, Jeff, who's also a very, I mean, he does, what's his name? Oh my God, Sam... I can't remember. He's like the voice oh my God, Sam. Anyways, Jeff is going to kill me for this. But we turned to each other at one point because we're buddy-buddy cops, right?
Oh, I see. And yeah. By Jeff the way, Tara Vanen? Probably butchering his last name.
Sam, he does Sam Fisher's voice. You know, Sam Fisher in all the video games.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he's the Sam Fisher. And by the way, you have to see the Blu-ray version of Thanksgiving because all the buddy cop scenes were unfortunately taken out because of time in the movie release. But in the Blu-ray release, all the buddy-buddy cop stuff is there.
Oh, cool.
At one point, Jeff and I turned to each other and we went, holy crap, this is good. You know, not just because of the actors that were in it, but just you have a sense that the cast is gelling together. The story is making sense. Everybody starts really throwing themselves into the movie. You know, there's something happening on set. I know it's a weird word to use, but it's almost like this magical moment that everything clicks into place and you go, oh, this is going to be good. And that happened on Thanksgiving. Jeff and I were sitting in a tent in a warehouse and we were cold as heck. And we turned to each other and we went, it's really cold. And we both went, but it's totally worth it. This movie is cool. You know? And by the way, the character that I play is based on a real life person.
Really? Somebody that like so Eli Roth or the writer knew?
The author of the film has a friend who's a real detective in real life. And they based my character off of him.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
No, in that movie, like when I first saw the first trailer for that, I'm like, I think it's so cool. Well, A, it's smart to do a movie about a holiday because that's what people, you know, when a holiday comes up, it's like, oh, it's Christmas. I got to watch Silent Night, Deadly Night, or like as like, you know, the horror genre fans. So it's pretty neat that there's a Thanksgiving. And I did hear that there might be another one.
It was greenlit. The script made. Yeah. Whether or not I'm in it, I don't know. I mean, I did. Being a visible minority in a horror film is like usually wearing the red shirt in Star Trek. You know, you're usually dead. But when I first read the script, I was like looking for the moment that Detective Chu dies.
Yeah.
Right. Because he's a visible minority. He must be burned or stabbed. And I'm like, oh my God, he lives to the, he's in the last scene. He's alive. So whether or not I'm in it, I don't know. But yeah, there will be a Thanksgiving too. Definitely it's been greenlit and the script's being made already.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Now, Russ, here's my favorite question to ask people because I always think it's so interesting. It's like this silly, not a silly thing, but it's like a meme that I saw online. And it's like one of the truest things that even though like people use memes and they use them as like information sources sometimes, and it's obviously bullshit and it's not real, like the stuff that's on there. But this one hit home so hard. Like you never know that last moment that you're going to like play hide and go seek with your friends or play like pick up basketball. Like there's never like that. So you never know sometimes to enjoy that moment. And I always like to ask this people question to people in film and TV, because it's like, you don't know what sometimes it's like not appreciating that first moment. So early on, did you keep any mementos from set? Like, did you have the wherewithal to be like, let me keep the script, or did you keep, Oh, that's awesome. I love that. That is so cool.
Yeah. I wanted that. And I said, hey guys, can I? And they go, if you take it, we see nothing. And they let me take it home. So
that's cool.
Yeah, I've taken a few mementos from a few films. I actually have one of my favorite mementos that I took from a film. I did a film with Chow Yun-fat called Bulletproof Monk.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he gave me the coat he wears in the entire film. He gave it to me, and he said, and he, at the end, because we were helping each other out in the film a lot, and at the end he goes, "I got one like this already." He took it, signed it, and he said, "Take this with you," and that's one of my prized possessions.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, yeah, because. You know, Chow Yun-fat. I mean, I grew up watching the guy, right? So
yeah, that's so cool. No, yeah. I always ask that question because it's like, yeah, you know, some people will be like, I've had answers of like, yeah, I keep all the scripts, but you know what's over there? A closet full of scripts. Like this guy, Stuart Penkin. He goes, Doug, I have a closet full of scripts. Maybe one day I'll make one of my kids have to deal with it. Or another actor, he was in a lot of Carpenter movies. So Carpenter gives like really cool gifts at the end, like really cool, like leather jackets and stuff. He's like, they're really cool, but I'm not going to wear like, you know, my jacket out to like the store. He goes, they're cool to have.
Yeah. Well, there's like, I mean, I have a whole bunch of that stuff. I have jackets from the Three Body Problem.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I got a whole bunch of memorabilia. Some of it. Yeah. I will never, but I do. I'm like a lot of other actors. I do have a storage room full of scripts. Because a lot of them have writing in them from directors. They have writing, like notes that other actors wrote down. I kept a lot of that stuff. You know, like
that's cool.
And now we're in PDF world. So I have my tablet now that we use on set. But again. All my notes are in there. The notes of other actors are in there. And I keep all the PDFs too.
Ah, no script. You know? Man, that's like it ticks me off that they don't have tickets anymore. Like when you go to like a sporting event, like going to a Yankee game and not having like a physical ticket to like save. Cause I used to love saving my tickets and putting them like an old box. But even with scripts, the scripts have fallen to that now too.
Yeah, but I'm old school. So sometimes I'll print out the script.
Oh, that is awesome.
I'll print out the script, even though it's not like everybody else is walking around with a pad. I'm still old school, so I'll print out the script.
Yeah.
That's a French TV series I did.
That's cool. No, it's like having the physical thing in your hand makes it feel like real. Even though I know the tickets work when I go into to a Knicks game, just having that physical ticket like makes me feel like it's like this weird thing. Even like printing stuff out to read, like textbooks nowadays, when I went back to school, they're all online. It's like a weird thing to stare at a screen. So it's like I'd print out like hundreds of pages. I'd be like, I know I'm killing trees, but like in the same set, it just feels like it's easier to learn the other way. Like just jotting notes. Like I know it's easy to write on a tablet or on a computer, but it's just not the same.
I have to admit though, when I'm in a really, if I have like, if I'm number 1, 2, 3, or 4 on a call sheet, mm-hmm. and I'm in a feature film, I'm sorry, but I'm printing that sucker out.
Yeah.
Because it just feels much more like more solid to me. If I'm doing a small role, I won't print it out. I'll keep it on the tablet, but I really love printing out stuff because it just feels much more tangible to me. You know, maybe it's because I started off that way, you know, like back in my day, there were no tablets or anything. So maybe it's because of that, but I work with a lot of younger kids now who just use their phone. Like I can't. And they're like on set looking at their phone and their lines. And I'm like, how are you doing that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, not only that, my eyesight, I can't read the phone because my eyesight's so bad. But besides that, you know, I'm just like, it's not, I don't know. It doesn't feel like acting, but that's just me.
Yeah. Now I hear you. Russ, this has been so much fun. This will be out, and I'll make sure to send you an email when this comes out. But this has been so much fun. Are you going to be a lot? So I know you're a huge fan of like the CFL, and you said you watch like college football. Are you going to be locked into like the draft tonight? Are you like, so you watch NFL too?
Yeah, I do. I do. I don't like looking at the drafts, honestly, because it's often just so long.
Oh, I know. You know, it's just a joke. Yeah.
It becomes like, for me, it's kind of like remember how the Oscars were a few years ago? Like you start watching it at 8 o'clock at 1:30 in the morning. Maybe it's over.
I know.
You know, it's just like, it's like, no, condense. Like they're getting it now. This year they got it right. Like, you know, let's go. So yeah, for me, the draft is kind of like that. It's just.
Yeah, they milk it. Now it's like first round Thursday, second and third Friday, Saturday, Sunday, all the, it's just for more, you know, revenue dollars from advertising. They try to stretch it out as much as they can. But to me, it's like, you never know who's going to hit. It's like such a crapshoot. You take the kids that are the best from high school that make it to college, and then you have the best kids from college, and hopefully they make it in the pros. I'm a Giants fan. So who do you root for? Do you have like a specific team?
Yeah, a lot of people hate me for it. I love Kansas City, man.
Oh, cool. No, okay, I think you're going to say Dallas. No, Kansas City's cool, man.
No. I mean, I just, you know what it is for me? It's the way Mahomes plays.
No, oh, yeah.
He's that, you know, there's the old style of playing and then there's the new style of playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love the way Mahomes plays because, you know, he'll be looking and you think he's going to pass. He's going to pass. He's going to, oh no, he's running, you know? And
yeah.
I like the unknown, the new style of play that he brings. So for me, I've always loved Kansas City, watching them play. I mean, before it was the Patriots.
Before it was the Patriots? Yeah. No, I don't blame you.
Yeah.
But with the thing about Mahomes, and I totally agree, it's definitely a new school thing, but he has this old school mentality of like the Elway, Jim Kelly, like the gunslingers. Even though the league is so pass happy, I feel like those other guys, there's a lot of quarterbacks that it's like hike, 1-2, throw a slant, throw a play, but like Mahomes like stretches out the plays so much. And
he'll dance around for ages, and then suddenly you realize, oh my God, there's a receiver in the end zone and nobody's covering him. You know? Yeah. I've been watching him since college, right? Like since he was in the when he got into NFL, I was just like, oh, I gotta watch this guy. But you know, I love that. I do love the gunslingers. I mean, I was a big Tom Brady fan for the longest time.
Oh yeah, dude.
You know?
Yeah.
I thought he was beautiful throwing. I mean, I just love watching him throw. The dynamics, the way the mechanics of him throwing was just like, oh, it's beautiful. But, you know,
Giants
football.
Took him down twice. Yes. That's my only saving grace. Even though he still has, God, he has like 8, I think.
Oh, I remember he showed one time.
Yeah, like I feel like
his fingers were covered with Super Bowl rings.
It's got to be set. It's got to be at least 7 because it's insane how good he was. But that's awesome, man. Russ, this has been so much fun. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Like I said in the email, I love more of the origin story, and I think that's so fascinating that it was like a throwaway class. Do you remember the actor Robert Hayes? He was in Airplane. His story is not exactly the same, but. His dad was in the military. So his dad was in the Navy. That was like the joke of it. And they were like stationed in Kansas, I think. And then in the middle of the semester, or just before his semester was about to start, he had a move. So then he was going to school in California, and it was like the last day. So he had to fill his classes, and what was left? Acting. And then he just fell in love with it.
No.
Yeah.
And that's how
That's it. Yeah. And I think it's so funny. Like, I've talked to a lot of people. It happens like a happy accident. Like, Brian Thompson, who plays like a villain, badass, like Cobra and a bunch of other movies. His was a girl was flirting with the guy that was in the play. And he was like, wow, why the hell is she flirting with him and not me? I'm going to go out for the play. And he became an actor from that. So I think that's what's so cool about acting. Because, like you said, you don't know you have it in you. It's like other things you have to sort of have it in you. To be a doctor, to be an engineer, there's like things you have to know. You can't like just wake up, not be good at school or not be good at math, and be like, oh, I'm going to do these things. But with acting, it's just something that you're sort of like born with, and then you just have to tap into, but you never know until you like have that opportunity like you had or so many other people. So I think it's so fascinating.
And it's all about opportunities too, right? Because I'm sure there's a lot of great actors out there. They just never get the opportunity. And it takes a lot of drive. But it also takes some good luck.
Oh, yeah. It's luck and then nailing that opportunity. Like Stephen Colbert said it best because he was the backup to Carell at Second City in Chicago. So he already...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the way... Yeah, so he was his understudy, but he always said, I forgot who told him. It wasn't Carell that told him, but some older actor said, hey, if you can just stick it out, like you're going to get your chance because so many people are going to come through here. Eventually, somebody's going to tab you for a sitcom or a pilot or a comedy series or something, but then you have to nail that opportunity. So he was like... So I just stuck it out. And then if I would have bombed on that opportunity, you wouldn't see me afterwards. So it's fascinating that you're right. It's definitely luck, but you have to nail that opportunity. Like everyone.
You do.
There's so many people, they talk about nepotism. And I know there's nepotism in Hollywood. But there's so many people that were thrown in our face, either nepotism or like Cindy Crawford as an actress. She starred in one movie. It bombed and everybody was like, yeah, we're not going to use it anymore. So like, there's those things, like there's all these factors, but you got to nail your chances.
Yeah. And the chance only comes around once.
Yeah.
You have to be 110% ready when that chance does come. See, 110% there. I'm talking like a sports guy.
Gave our 110%, man. But
you can't do that.
Where's that extra 10%? I forgot. Is that like a Seinfeld bit? I feel like that's a Seinfeld bit. But
I think it's a Seinfeld bit. Yeah, I think it must be.
Yeah.
But thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
No, this is fun, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your story.
No problem. Anytime. Take care.
Thanks, Russ.
Isn't it amazing that they actually record the voiceover for an adult film in a place that looks like they would film an adult film? It's quite fascinating. I guess you have to have that vibe. You're voiceovering the product that you're watching. You have to be in a similar skeevy environment for some of the low budget ones. Obviously, we've had some amazing guests that have worked on top productions that have big budgets, but obviously there's the latter as well. But yeah, thank you, Russell. I had so much fun. Now your homework, Scanners 2, it's free everywhere. It's on Tubi, Pluto, I think even Amazon Prime, but Tubi's the way to go. So that'll be a lot of fun to discuss that. So don't forget to review, rate, share our podcast, follow us on all social media at Sequels Only, and don't forget to check out our website, sequelsonly.com. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, guys.